and all of a sudden you've got a 400 point unit and 600 points of support.
Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most Tucker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. We are the Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Evening, everybody.
And Tanya Gates.
Hey, everybody.
Real sorry to release last week's episode a little bit late. Schedules got all jammed up. I went to two different conventions over the course of one weekend.
So you didn't sleep?
Yeah. It didn't get released because Paul is lazy and wasn't busy at all. 100%.
Normally, I try to get it done, but it was just a little too much. And I really wanted to get that show out because it had those two great community spotlight segments. And so fun to have people on, you know, that are really great at what they do out there, you know, come on our show and tell us about it a little bit. So I was excited to get it out. Definitely wanted to let people know that we wanted to get it out on time and why it didn't happen. Please forgive us.
So, Nova, tell us a story, mate. How long have you been back from Nova? Did you get back yesterday or the day before?
Yesterday, yeah. Yeah.
Have you fully recovered?
Yeah, today is strength? No, I'm not. I have not fully recovered, but only because it was just such a good time. A lot of enthusiasm. You could tell people hadn't been there in a couple of years and they wanted to be there, and you know, a lot of good activity in the gaming hall and in the vendor area. The Age of Sigmar area was in a different hotel. There was like some of the events that were basically right across the street from the main hotel. And we walked over there every now and then to see what's up. Some pretty cool people hanging out, playing some board games. And when the Age of Sigmar tournament wasn't happening. And a lot of good social activity. The hotel bar area was a cool place to hang out. Saw lots of cool people. Saw some folks that listened to the show. Really appreciated it. Hearing what's up, you know, while I was there. And then also hanging out with those folks.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and then talked about Warhammer a lot. You can actually find the coverage up on the Warhammer TV Twitch stream. We streamed 9 games.
Dude, it's a lot. No, Nova was a lot. Even I was at a tournament on the weekend, and I was tracking how Nova was going. And man, you just forget like what 9 games does to the mind.
I say we streamed 9 rounds as 18 games.
Oh, because you were doing 2 tables per.
Yeah.
Yeah, yikes.
It's cool, though. I mean, we got to see some cool elements of strategy. You got to get in some of the minds of some players. We had a list with 2 Land Raiders on it. You know, like
which faction was that? Chaos Space Marines?
Chaos Space Marines, or? Yeah. They were using the Super Land Raiders.
The T9, yeah. G-Dubs really let the handle off on the toughness. We've got multiple T9 units in the game now, but only for Chaos so far, which I think is interesting. I would have thought the first team, if they're going to do T9, I thought Big Knights maybe went to T9, but here we are.
Just let the bad guys have the extra toughness.
Yeah, totally. I'm totally down for it. I think, oh yeah, cool, they're 10,000 years old, give it to them.
Did orcs get the extra toughness?
They did, but they got nothing that's T9.
It's T5 since Fury.
Yeah. Well, technically, I think Tyranid Warriors went from T4 to T5 as well. Like all that stuff did. All the Raveners and the Pyrovores and
the
Biovores. Yeah, all the bad stuff. Yeah.
Perspective. So,
yeah. All the bad guys. Although, Tanya, do you believe orcs are bad guys? See, I think orcs are the purest of souls in the 41st millennium.
I think they're probably the closest thing that you have to good guys because they're just looking to party, you know?
Yeah, there's very little malice in what they do. They just do it because it's what they do. It's like breathing to them.
Exactly.
You know, I used to think, like, when Tau first got released, like in, like, 4th edition, I used to think Tau were the only possible good guys, and now that's out the window. Like, totally, you know, after a couple of issues, like, no way that the Tau are the good guys, can be called the good guys anymore.
Yeah, there really are no good guys, but orcs are probably, like, chaotic neutral.
Orcs and Nids, I think, because they're the two ones that just do what they do, what they program to do, what they're born and created to do. They don't... you couldn't call what they do evil because the evil, you know, means that, you know, their intent, they exist.
Yeah. I don't think
they do what their old mates do when they were.
Yeah. I don't think they have any intent.
Yeah.
Just living in the moment.
Exactly.
Right. Just living their best lives.
Right.
All those kings and queens, swarm lords.
They're in their lane. They're moisturized and glowing.
We should start a new hashtag for like, if you just identify as biomass, being my best biomass hashtag.
That's very funny. In the top 16, there were 9 different factions represented. So very diverse meta there at the top.
Lovely.
Yeah, you like.
Well, I was
like
going to say, would anything take you by surprise for what performed or did really well?
You know, the Necrons have consistently not been doing that great, and you know, I really thought.
I thought, holy crap, is he serious? And they're like, no, of course not.
Almost got me there.
Well, I saw going into the pre-ultimate to the top cut round. So it was going into the round of five, I believe, into the round of six. There was a lot of Necrons. But because they're all super high scoring, they all played each other in the last couple of rounds, right?
Yeah. They ended up only being 3 in the top 16 after, you know, a big chunk did either get beaten, you know, or ended up having to play themselves. You know, it does happen.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of time when Necrons play each other, it's whoever teched better for the mirror match or whoever went first. Going first for Necrons is so strong, especially in the mirror, because they can score like 15 secondary points top of turn one, right. Not even the bottom of turn one.
That's true.
So they just go first, score all the stuff, deny you doing the same on your turn because they're on the objectives you need to do those actions on, and then off we go. The snowball, the pebble down the mountain becomes the avalanche.
Yeah, the Eldari list, they came in second, actually, with 3 Falcons and an Avatar Kane. I didn't really expect that to go as deep as it did.
You love to see it. I love to see the Avatar doing good. It's, yeah.
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 And then just with like obvious list tech, like something that has been chosen either because, you know, the player knows it inside and out or because they think it gives them some advantage in what they're going to see out there. I love that kind of creativity and seeing that list perform and then in the hands of someone who really knows the faction. That was nice. So I will say I wasn't surprised by the player, you know, doing well, but I was surprised that that list and that configuration got as deep as it did.
Fantastic.
There's still room out there for people to kind of innovate within their faction.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of what we were afraid. Nephilim was going to cut a lot of the flavor out of lists and it was going to pigeonhole people. Like we were going to see, oh, this is just the best Custodes list and no one ever varies from the accepted best. But it hasn't seemed to be the case. It seems like there may be like 15, 16, even 1800 points of a list that is the best things you can do. But because the meta is so fluid and there are so many different armies that can perform well, people can't just lock themselves in because then they become a target for the anti-meta players. They will just be like, well, if they're always playing this, well, I just take this and then I win that game or get closer. Was there anything you saw was surprising from... Well, so I don't know. I'm just looking at the standings now for the Age of Sigmar event because I was interested to see what's performing over there.
That was in a different building. I really didn't see any of that play. By the time I got over there, they were ready to hang out and do something else like we were.
Well, because, they played one less round. They played 8 rounds. I suppose that's just the number of players they had, which was still a very respectable 135. But their top 8 cut had only one double up? Wow. So they had Disciples of Zench took it all out. Iron Jaws came in second. Seraphon in third. Beast of Chaos in fourth. Skaven Tide in fifth. Sylvaneth in sixth. And then 2 Daughters of Cain in seventh and eighth. That's cool. What a spread.
Oh, Sylvaneth, I think you check that list out because I've been I've been dragging my feet getting my Sylvaneth army modernized. So maybe that'll give some inspiration.
In Age of Sigmar, Disciples of Zench aren't really considered to be that great. However, Anthony Trentinelli is that great. So one might be a little bit of like an outlier. If you were just looking at the faction itself, you might be like, that's weird. But then you see who it is and you're like, yeah, it makes sense.
It's gone. Well, so the winner here was a guy like Caleb Walters. But maybe they're playing a very similar list or they're close sparring buddies.
Oh, okay. So I was looking at the RTT. My bad.
Easy. That's all good.
Well, nice to see those players out there rocking and rolling. The hobby on display during at least on the 40K side, and I'm sure the same is on the Age of Sigmar side, was probably better pound for pound than I've seen at most tournaments. Just stellar armies.
I don't know about you guys over in the States, but in Australia, like the event I just went to on the weekend, was the best per capita, the per player was some of the best hobby standards that I've ever seen. My stuff's painted pretty good. Like, I think my stuff's painted a rung or two above table standard. Like, it's painted like maybe a rung higher than Parade Ready by G-Dub, you know, a rung or two higher than, than what they consider is the fully painted good standard. And mine's a couple of levels higher than that. And I didn't even make, like, there was 80 players and my army wasn't even in like the top 15 or 20 best painted at that event. It was like absolutely nuts how good some of this stuff was. And I just had such a good time walking around lunchtime when everyone had stuff set up on display. So you guys know House Terran for Imperial Knights. It's the Ultramarines of Imperial Knights. It's just blue, a little bit of splashed red. And one of those armies won best painted. It was so beautifully executed that it won best painted. Like, sometimes you can just do like a really basic scheme and just knock it out of the freaking park with like transfers.
You could have thrown a rock and picked any table it landed on to get them on the stream. I mean, that's what it felt like walking around there at the Nova Open.
So is it like the same caliber as Adepticon? Because I saw some of the armies from Adepticon and they were mind-blowing.
So the Adepticon team tournament is like the real spectacle. The singles event, I'd say for the singles events, this is better. Like the per average, we're better. But the team tournament's something else. That's a that's where that was at. So again, I was really impressed walking around there and seeing all that stuff.
Do you think it's because of COVID? Everyone had to take like 2 years off to get rid of their backlogs and paint all this stuff up extra good?
Maybe so. You know, it's like, yo, I'm sitting here for another week. Let me just get this edge highlight on.
I will say in my local group, that did not happen. Nobody painted over COVID. People were like, oh, I'm not going to go play my army anywhere, so why bother?
Oh, I legit thought I was going to have at least one more army painted during that time. It did not happen.
Yeah, motivation was hard to come by.
I did get some stuff done, but like I was expecting just to do a whole army. Like, oh, I'm going to do it. It's going to be great. And then, you know.
What was your army plan? Like, what did you want to get done?
Adeptus Oratus. That's what I was going to do.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it didn't happen, though. I have a lot of figures.
Well, boo.
I know.
Shame.
I'm ready when the next, you know, whatever happens.
When the next pandemic rolls around, I'll know what to do that time. May it never happen.
Definitely get that army done. No, but it was just, again, spectacle. Loved it. Loved hanging out. The people were cool. Getting to talk to folks, you know, that you only see a couple times a year. Always very cool. So if it is, you know, something that you feel right about doing, I highly encourage you to get out to these events. And the next one I'm going to is the U.S. Open event in Chicago. That's the first weekend in October, like the 6th through the 9th or something like that.
Yeah, it's a month away now. So that's pretty close.
Yeah.
You're shoutcasting that one?
I will be, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's gonna be good times. So I again come hang out. You get to also see the cool stuff. Get to see the Games Workshop store. I don't know if anything like the Kill Team Live will be there, but I know there'll be lots of cool painting classes and everything. The full run of things. It's kind of like the total experience for a grand.
And we're getting into really kind of juicy, crunchy end of the ITC season. For those competitive minded players out there, things are really starting to ramp up. Like, we've got the LGT coming up, which is probably going to be the second biggest singles event in the world. And then, yeah, it's all chugging along until the LVO and the big song and dance to wrap up what is essentially the first full year of tournament play, event play since 2019.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's another thing. If you're wanting ITC points, wanting faction points, these are great places to get them that we're talking about. Hobby track points, all kind of things to get awarded for. And we'll be talking about this stuff on the Thursday show over on the Frontline Gaming Network.
Ah, good plug. This week we got a couple of options for what we're gonna put on the show. There's two big team events, one in Spain, one in Australia, and then we've got a super stacked GT also in Australia, and then a bunch of really nice big events in the States and the UK. So actually, sorry, I don't think the UK has any big ones, but it's going to be a good show, as it always is.
Yeah, it's always a fun time. That's myself, Adam Camilleri, and Dustin Henshaw over on, if you couldn't guess, the Thursday show. And we record that live in front of a studio audience.
Well, I record that on Fridays Friday, thank you very much.
Oh, so, on your Friday.
Yeah, it's misleading. But what's going to be interesting is this will be the first week where demons are in full effect.
Oh, that's right. I guess people would have had it in hands and know it. You know, you just people can't wait to get it on the table.
I'm really excited about this book. Is it weird that this feels like it's four supplements in a trench coat? And I think I've said that on my own show, but it having reviewed the whole book now and gone over it a couple of times, it really feels like it's four books, four individual books that they built to work together pretty seamlessly. But they do feel like four very distinct flavors, which I'm extremely stoked about. I think it's cool.
There's enough kind of juicy bits to keep you interested in any particular faction, which I do like. And I will say that I'm kind of excited about the potential of throwing three great unclean ones at someone like 6 inches away.
Yeah, it's a mechanic that we haven't had to deal with in 9th edition. It was very much prevalent in 8th edition where you'd always have to be screening and watching for, like, everyone had a mechanic that let them arrive from reserve and get a good charge off against you. You know, orcs would do it, GSC would do it. Some space marines would do it, arriving from strategic reserve and having 3d6 charges. I think Raven Guard or, you know, shadow stepping and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, now it's like this is the first time we've seen it brought back en masse as a mechanic in 9th edition. And people are going to have to be like ready. It's gonna change how you want to play the game.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, especially for things this big. I mean, there is no sometimes limit. Or sometimes with that kind of things, it was only one unit, like Gene Stealers or whatever. You only have a couple of different real options about what you could do that with.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, now it's just like everything in your opponent's army could potentially, well, up to 50% of your opponent's army could potentially be doing these things.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I don't think three bloodthirsters is quite 50%. So
you're fine. But there is that nice caveat that G-Dub put the mechanic in with the demonic locus that does, well, it's not a hamstring mechanic. It just means you've got to be a bit selective with your application and gives your opponent a little bit of like say in how you're going to try and mess them over.
You mean as far as they can maybe identify what your locuses are and do something about it?
Where you have to place them, where their ranges are, you know, stuff like that. Where they're likely to end up. Because they can only move so far, and then you can only deep strike off that model so far. So the idea would be that because people generally will only be able to have one locus per army, depending, it can be a little bit predictable about where they go, and you can at least have some interplay.
Let me help you out with this locus thing. The feculent Narmal is a warp locus.
Correct.
The feculent
Narmal. Who else is a warp locus?
Narmal is 75 points.
Yeah, but see, that's a terrain piece you place on the table. And then you have to deep strike within range of that terrain piece in order to get there. So it's just like, so to me, when you put the Narmal down, it's just like, okay, cool. There is a like 18-inch exclusion zone around that terrain piece where I do not go. That is the land of death.
I just think that you can place them up near objectives. Now, what may be different than in previous editions and versions of this is that this does have a toughness and wound. So you can destroy it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I actually didn't know that.
Yes, T7, awesome. With 9 wounds.
Spicy.
So it's not like something that's just this is not a surefire plan. So what you're saying was absolutely true. Like identifying what the locuses are and then figuring out ways to dismantle that potential plan is, you know,
yeah,
got to be number one thing on your opponent's mind. If you're like, well, so you tell them you put three bloodthirsters in reserve.
Yeah. The real cute thing here is though, there's one locus that isn't on a greater demon in the book. Well, and not on a terrain piece. And that's on a Slaanesh Herald, the Enrapturous, I think. The one with the really cool harp made of nerves stuff. So that's the only one that can be bodyguarded. It's under 10 wounds. So you can run that up behind the rest of your army and then deep strike stuff. And then that one can move advance out and then deep strike because every other one essentially. Yeah. It's so cool. There was such a chat for a long time about people like some grognards grumbling about chaos losing how kind of messed up it is. Losing the vile and the scary factor of chaos, and then that model came out, and they're like, "Oh yeah, this is fine. This is
right." back on track.
it's fine.
Because that's right. Because like Slaanesh supposedly took a backseat to the Skaven god, the Greyhorn Rat.
Yeah, Greyhorn Rat. Which was I wouldn't mind. Would you, how would you guys be if they put the Greyhorn Rat in 40K?
Why do you think the Great Horned Rat is not in 40K?
Because, I don't know. It doesn't have rules, I guess. It's not.
I'm almost positive.
It's not one of the four supplements wearing a hat.
At the end times, the Skaven like looked into the 40K universe.
And they were like, yeah, no, this is too messy, even for us.
No, I think I'm not positive because it's been a while since the end times came out, but I think there's some reference to 40K in the Skaven.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Stuff.
Also,
if
has anyone realized?
That's the case, if that's the case, though, shouldn't Khaldor Drago end up in Age of Sigmar?
I would love that.
I think there may even be a reference to something like that as well. Like, I think y'all hit on a couple of Easter eggs. I mean, this could just be internet speak and conjecture and wishful thinking.
That would be fantastic. I'm all about it.
I don't think it's too far off the mark.
What if Sigmar is actually Khaldor Drago?
Yeah, it's just
could be.
Yep.
With the warp locus, I did not catch that it was on the Infernal Enraptress.
Yeah, it's a big deal. That's the one I think that gives Slaanesh a lot of spice for the I guess it's the list where you don't want to take, you know, be all in oops or greater demons. Because I do think there are plays for the greater demon lists and there are plays for a bunch of the smaller units. Although G-Dub, I made a comparison that G-Dub was doing something they haven't done with demons with this codex, which was incentivizing the middle tier demons. I think the previous book in 8th edition really incentivized all the demonic infantry, the lesser demons, you know, the bloodletters, the horrors, especially the horrors and the bloodthirst and the plague bearers became staples of 8th edition. And then the bloodletters as well to a lesser extent. But the demoness really didn't leave a huge mark outside of a few niche, like, all-in builds. And now I feel like this one's going down the route where you want a bunch of flamers, you want a bunch of, you know, Beasts of Nurgle or Plague Drones, you want a bunch of Fiends and Flesh Hounds. Like, it's really cool to see some, like, G-Dub spreading the love around a bit, being like, hey, what didn't people take at all last edition? Well, let's give them some love.
I don't mind that. Plus, I mean, you know, give some variance in the list that you're going to see. So, I guess the, what I mean by that is the silhouette of the armies that you're going to see, which would be cool because you'll have your troops, you'll have, you know, a decent amount of, you know, elites and bigger profiles and stuff like that, and then you'll have some HQ leading it, most likely.
Well, yeah, and also it is informing you to do the only rational thing to do in the modern era of the game, which is to have a complete collection of an army. Don't just go 2,000 points of an army. Get flesh it out, have a bit of everything, and therefore, you know, whatever changes out there meta-wise or game-wise or rules-wise, you'll always have something you can enjoy.
Yeah, we heard even that talking to our faction specialist last week with, you know, no, I was prepared. I already had a bunch of demons, you know, so.
Perfect.
No problem. But that's kind of way, it's not a reality for everybody to have a bunch of extra models all the time, but it is kind of cool when you do kind of insulate yourself from edition changes or codex updates or whatever if you have kind of a big stack of stuff either on your hobby shelf waiting to be done, your pile of potential, or in your painted arsenal.
Totally agree.
Someone has been telling me, like, all on Hordicus Slimix is supposed to be really good.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite models in the range.
Yeah.
In the demon range. Absolutely awesome.
Do you know why people may be hot on this guy?
Apart from his innate beast buffing ability, and beasts seem like a very powerful data sheet, I'm not sure if their points cost is going to be enough to keep them down, because they are quite expensive at 80 points.
The beast are 80 points, and he does let Beast of Nurgle or Plague Drones reroll charges made, and then also add one to the attack's hit roll. So he is a pretty big buff character.
It's pretty good. Yeah, I'm all about it. I think he's awesome. And the model's fantastic, and the rules seem pretty good. So yeah. Absolutely right there.
I guess that's right. You can just bust everybody. So here, Legio's Demonica Nurgle core unit within 6 inches of this model. Each time the model in that unit makes an attack, you can reroll wound roll of one. And then he has a beast handler, which does all of the stuff we were just talking about. He does some other stuff too. Basically, he does stuff in airy terrain. So I guess we just answered that question. He does a lot of stuff.
Does a lot of stuff. And, you know, it reminds me of Neverending Story. So, you know, that's got points on it as well.
Because he's the snail rider?
A rider, that's right.
Nice.
Would Horticulus Slimix be considered a force multiplier? And can you please explain to me what exactly a force multiplier is?
That's a good question.
Very good question.
Yeah, I think you've hit it there, is that sometimes that term just may get thrown around. Anything that gives you more value out of more than one thing. So the fact that it is, he gives a buff to any friendly model within six is, I think, enough to kind of call him a force multiplier. And with the bonus in the command phase, be able to buff up a unit that you might already want to take, although I don't think that's a prerequisite with the force multiplier. I think the anything that gets you something that like one unit can punch at 1.5 times efficiency or 2 times the efficiency because something is by, you would call them a force multiplier, and like an actual force multiplier.
It speaks to how we categorize different units as well. A lot of units in 8th edition were kind of one or the other. They were a false multiplier, or they were a beat stick, or they're a support character. I suppose a support character would be something like a chaplain or a librarian, something there that gave out a single buff or a double buff. A force multiplier, I think of as somebody who gives out an aura or exclusively buffs a unit of, like in Horticlux's example, buffs all of something within range, like something that gives out an AoE effect. I usually classify as a force multiplier. And then you have, like, at the upper extent of unit choices, you know, things like your Primarchs, your Supreme Command takeable options, they become, you know, multiples of their beat sticks plus support characters plus force multipliers. Gilliman's a great example, you know, is a monster, a beat stick, is a... I also you can put in the fridge as well. Like, there is an option for a character for there to be the fridge kind of. I put that in air quotes when, because remember Lysander in like 5th edition,
Khalgar or Tor Gheradan.
So we used to call Lysander. Well, I don't know if this was ubiquitous around the world, but back in the day when we were playing in like 4th, 5th, 6th edition, we would call Lysander the fridge, because he had a storm shield in Terminator armor with Eternal Warrior. As in, like, you could not one shot the guy.
Yeah, okay.
And so he was the fridge. You had a problem unit, march Lysander in it, and he'll keep it there all game. So there is that option out there as well. But that's kind of going away a lot. So a force multiplier for me is something that gives out an AoE buff or gives out an exclusive buff to multiple units. It's something that takes a unit that I already want to take and makes it better. And whether that's worth it in your mind, you know, so be it. I suppose this gentleman or the people who are high on Horticlux are high on Horticlux because they're high on beasts, they're high on plague drones. They're like, this guy is worth it because the things he does is relevant to the units I want to take. And that'd probably be how I classify. But it's actually a really good topic, Tanya, to bring up, because the way we weigh these things up is really important. You remember 8th edition guys? Like, you'd have characters in your army that were exclusively there to do killing. I'm talking about like Blood Angels, Smash Captains. You'd have units in your army that were there to exclusively buff and activate units, you know, like company commanders, platoon commanders, librarians. The Ancient that used to make things shoot back on death on a 2+. False multiplier, you know. So yeah, it's really cool. It's a topic or a little piece of nuance that we don't really delve that deep into all that often.
Yeah, it's just a term that I hear being thrown around, and like, I thought I understood what that term was, but then I've also had people be like, oh no, that character is not a force multiplier. So I'm like, oh, you actually don't know what this means then. So
I look at anything that does not you know, really just have one target for its stuff. And there's a lot of chaos stuff that way. And you could even put it on something like, you know, the fight's last ability is a force multiplier because it makes sure that you're going to get to do your stuff.
Yeah. I suppose that we get to the discussion of, you know, how much of your army can you have allocated to force multiplication before it takes away from just having enough stuff to be relevant. Like Death Stars, yeah, back in 7th edition, not so much relevant in 8th, but you would take one unit
Death Stars.
but what I mean is, like, points wise, you would take one unit of Flesh Hounds, say 10 of them, equating to, you know, probably 100-ish odd points, maybe less than 150, and then you would add in 600 points of characters, you know, that kind of stuff, because you'd add in 5 sorcerers, maybe a chaos lord, you know, and then that army would also have Fate Weaver and a Demon Prince or some crazy crap like that, and you know, that it would become an unkillable object. We don't have quite that extent in 40k, but we do have equivalents, and the perfect one you said there, Paul, was chaos terminators right now. A 10 brick of terminators, you can spend 400 points on that 10 brick of terminators, and then take a Baden for 300 points, take a Dark Apostle for 100 odd points, take a Master Possession for 100 odd points, take a friggin' a regular sorcerer for 100 odd points, and all of a sudden you've got a 400 point unit and 600 points of support.
I'm trying to figure out if that's bad or not in my head right now.
Oh, well, it's actually not. It's doing really well. But I mean, there is a line where the juice isn't worth the squeeze, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk more random stuff. See you in a minute.
More random stuff. Summed up nice.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. Thanks for checking out our sponsors. Please don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. You can also leave us 5-star reviews in Spotify. I know we talk a lot about iTunes and the other aggregators, but Spotify is someplace. If you are listening to us brand new, hit that 5-star review. It means a lot. That's like a real easy way that you can kind of telegraph that you like the show, and maybe some other people will find the show, and it makes our hearts swell.
It does. It just livens up my day.
I check every day.
And if you leave,
it's refresh.
If you leave a really sweet comment, then he shares it in the group chat with us, and then we all go, "Aww."
He does. It's actually really nice. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, that does brighten my day.
Yeah, so thank y'all for that. All that have done it so far, and that will do it in the future. Adam, in the pre-show, you brought up a great topic: is, you know, how do we as the player community judge the success of a codex? You know, of a brand new something, some brand new release, you know, major release like a faction or something in the community, or just as a whole.
it's become pretty apparent that we're almost at the end of the codex releases for this edition. I think we've got what, Votann, World Eaters, and Guard that they've said are, you know, going to be take us to the end of the year. And then, I mean, past supplements and possibly redoing some bits and pieces, like maybe they do Space Marines again because they did it last edition. Maybe that's a pattern they're doing. Main boys get two. But apart from that, we're coming to the crunchy bit of the edition where we have to look back and see, you know, how do we evaluate the success of an army book? How do we say whether this one was good, that one was bad, indifference, you know, this one's a pass and a fail, et cetera, et cetera. Is it even valuable to do so, you know? Coming from my own show is a review show where I do rate codexes, I would love to have a discussion upon, you know, what we measure. What is the measuring stick for success? Like, how do we determine whether it's a book that was good for the player base, bad for the player base, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, with balance updates and that kind of stuff, I think it's kind of cool to evaluate this stuff from time to time to see, you know, what, you know, I don't want to say isn't balanced or isn't good, but what, you know, what is not hung in there or is punching it, you know, at an equal weight to everything else that's been errated. So, I mean, that's no reason not to look back.
So I think the evaluation is going to be different based off why you play the game, like what's important to you about playing the game, right? So if you take the Orc Codex, for example, when that came out and then the Orcs had that one specific type of build that was just oppressive, a lot of competitive players would say that the Orc Codex is a great book, right? Because you could make a list, and that list could go and win you a GT.
Perfectly said. That's definitely one of the metrics that we should be asking ourselves, like, how important is internal balance, and how well do we weigh that up? Because is anybody able to define what internal balance is for people who may be unaware?
I mean, I would say internal balance in a codex is when you can see a use for every unit or pretty close to every unit in the codex. If you can pick up your favorite unit in your army and you can find a place for it in an army list and it could be somewhat effective, I would say that that is an internally balanced codex.
Yeah, it's how to simplest way probably is to say it's how well fleshed out it is when measured against each other, unit to unit inside the same book, right? And how many different sub-factions and how many different stratagems and relics and wall of traits, et cetera, you find a reason or a purpose for. And we have examples of very good ones. And I think you gave us an example of one that was a little bit lacking, because apart from that, it was a freebooters list you were referring to, yeah, upon release of the Orc Codex?
Yeah, and it had like the planes, and I think it had mech guns and buggies. There's a few different types of builds, but that was sort of like the trope or...
Yeah, the archetype.
Yeah.
And yes, spot on, because once that went away, and it did need to go away, yes. Orcs have never found another build that gave them even a percentage of that success at the top level. Of course, we're talking about this through a lens of relative competitiveness, because that's where you find out. Well,
that's just one metric to judge by. I mean, if we're talking about success of things, and I mean, or if it was successful in the eyes of the player base kind of thing, or the fans of the factions, and what to look for.
On my show, I generally rate upon two metrics we talk about. And one of them, I simply say, how good do you think this is for the players of said faction? So I just did the final review of the Chaos Demons, second half of the Chaos Demons book. And I asked the gentleman I reviewed it with, how good do you think this codex is for the player base? And they gave me a score out of 10. A 5 would be, it's exactly the same as the previous book, and therefore a pass, like, or a minimum pass. Below 5 being it's worse than the previous book, above 5 being it's better, and then, you know, why not, et cetera, et cetera. And then the other one being, you know, where it's going to sit competitively, because it's on a competitive network. But those are two metrics that I find are very pigeonholed because of the format of my show. And yeah, I'd really love to get some more perspectives. Like, how do we rate how good a codex is for hobbyists or collectors? Like, is internal balance a good metric for that? Because there's a lot of reason to buy a lot of different models, and therefore have a beautiful collection, have a lot of hobby opportunities.
I think it is. It's important.
I mean, that is a consideration, and I look at it in this, it's very much in line with my opinion of that. To judge whether or not a codex is good or great is the depth within it. And as a just a for instance, and to kind of support the example that we're kind of talking about, is in years past, you know, like the Tau Codex was, you could build a very good build out of it, a list build. If you stray too far from that, then you did not get the same results on the tabletop.
So you're saying that was an example of poor internal balance, but the top end was always pretty up there.
It was a good codex because if you were a Tau player, you could play something. In my mind, because I'm judging everything from a, you know, what do we see on the tournament tabletop also, you know, not necessarily. I mean, you can, when you're playing a game or a narrative, you know, any other kind of experience outside of a tournament, you can set boundaries on, you know, whatever you think should be in a list or shouldn't be in a list, or scale for certain things. But, you know, when you're coming to a, you know, what we now know or we're now referred to as a match play event, there's, you know, those rules are defined. You can't, like, hey, you know, in round 4 of the event, you can't be like, hey man, I really prefer it if you didn't take 3 Riptides, you know, that kind of thing. You can't have that conversation.
I mean, you can ask, but
yeah. You know, but it wouldn't happen. So I looked at the codex was good because you could play something and it was very powerful. There was a linear path to that power. And if you strayed too far off that, you were deluding yourself. You've kind of fell off the cliff and you couldn't hope for those same results. And so I think that's what separated it from being a great codex, is that there just wasn't that depth. Whereas we have a lot of great codexes, in my opinion, now, is that there are, you know, different paths to a list for you to go out and play and be successful. But there's a lot of different components to that. Like, we have been through now a couple of balance updates and you know, point changes and the secondaries for missions. You know, those are, I mean, I know they're now a result of codex secondaries, or now Nephilim secondaries, but at the same time, do we consider the updates in this discussion, or are you just talking about at release?
I think to get it to a place of stability before we have to get it really well defined before we start taking the updates into account, because then essentially you have to reevaluate everything upon a set metric every time there's an update. Yeah, like, has this changed where they were? Because we need to establish where they were upon release or how good it was, and then you slap on the patches, which I've been calling them patches, the data slates, the chapter approved, like they're patching the codex, they're patching the game, like they would, you know, a League of Legends or a StarCraft. But I think we need to set the criteria and then be willing to be fluid as the edition unfolds and as the game changes. And so you have like a start and an end point, but you have a journey between the two for the life of a book. And I think it's really important to stay on the, to ride the wave, so to speak. But there is one metric that I want to capture that I've never really figured out how to do. And it's the, it's how thematic a book is, how thematic an army feels when you put it on the tabletop, which I think something that GW has done a great, has done really well. It's, it essentially, in my mind, it's, Sixth edition was the last time I remember a book coming out and feeling super thematic to how I felt they played. Fifth edition, I think, was the heyday of that. And then sixth edition, we lost it a bit. Seventh edition, we lost it a whole lot. Eighth edition, we lost a bit of it, but not. It started coming back. And then ninth edition, it's back with a vengeance. Books feel like you think they should. You read the fluff and then you pay the army and you're like, this lines up. Like, I think Death Guard's a perfect example of that. Gene Stealer Cult's a perfect example of that as well, where you read the fluff, you get immersed in the story and the background of an army, then put it on the table and it lines up with what you imagined. And that's something that I want to be able to capture when I ask people, how good do you think a book is? That should, I, do you guys feel like that should be a metric that we value in this hobby?
Yeah, maybe we get this like a you know, five categories that we assign. You know, I don't know, you know, it's subjective, but to a codex, I think theme and expectations of the lore should be one of those. Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful. What about you, Tanya?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really important. Like, I think maybe my biggest concern, I have a lot of concerns about like the old guard codex. Can't wait for a new one. But my concern is that it's really sort of hard to flood the board with bodies in any sort of meaningful way that kind of reflects how the guard actually work. Also, it's a little bit difficult with like list building to make tank companies work the way that you think that they should based off of the lore. Obviously, when you're playing competitively, it doesn't matter. You're not going to play them that thematically because it's not conducive to winning games. But if you are, if you are a lore player, you kind of almost don't want to mix infantry and tanks, right? Because that's not how the sort of structure of the Imperial Guard works. So I would say that is probably a big concern for some people.
About that metric being, you know, this just isn't a possibility because it's just not how the competitive game is played. So therefore, it's not a value to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think
the whole reason I...
We made good codex is coming out. I mean, that's my actual opinion here is that there has been a pretty good mix between theme and then now with the secondaries getting a lot of attention, it's not only just theme, it's that you can play into what is good about your army and you're going to score points during the course of the game.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of how them using the secondaries to assist in making things feel a certain way, adding flavor through how and crafting secondaries and the missions to make people want to play the game in certain ways. I'm a huge fan of that because you can take the best things in your codex. You can min max and optimize whatever you want. But if it doesn't result in points on the board, you're actually just going to lose a lot in the current edition. And I think that's exactly where we want the game to be.
Yeah, we're seeing that actually happen.
Well, yeah, Necrons is a perfect example. Like that, Necrons is an army that I would say has a very thematic book, but not one that has good data sheets. Like they're underpowered. Like the power on there, when you look at their units and you compare, say, any one of their melee units, flayed ones, you know, so to speak, compare them to Repentia. Essentially, neither of them are troops' choices. They both occupy kind of the same slots in an army, and supposedly for the same purpose. Yet these two things cannot be compared. They don't line up in any way. Repentia are just hands down better across every metric. And yet, you know, the Necron army, the way it plays on the table, is extremely rewarding. And the fact that they have weaker units doesn't matter because everything that they do results in a huge scoreline. So even if they are dying, even if you are getting punished, if what you're doing is rewarding you with points, you're winning games.
I don't think it's fair to compare anything to the Repentia.
No, me either. That's why I use them, because they're like the top of the pile. Point for... They are like in their own
nightmares,
so to speak. Yeah, dude. Yeah.
That's funny. So, I mean, I guess with this, the codex is like, what's a successful codex and what it means? Yeah, that I think it is. I mean, with the variance that is supported in there, you know, there's things we're not even talking about. The Crusade rules, the open play stuff, you know, narrative play stuff. Like, what is you know, there's so many different levels. And I know we talk about largely about efficiency of list. I don't even necessarily competitive, but what are value choices, efficient choices, and how to build a list that will win more games than it loses.
There's one last metric that I don't think there's any way to capture, but I think it's possibly the most important one. And that is how much passion a book inspires in the player. Like, there's nothing that will make somebody get a big, like, from GW's, and this is purely from Games Workshop's point of view, nothing will make people buy a book, play a book for a full edition, buy a whole army, paint it beautifully, then being passionate about the game and about the rules that they've been given. I have no way that I know to measure that apart from asking people's opinions. But if you could, we could capture that in a bottle, like that passion, because that's, I don't know what fuels other people out there, but passion for a faction is what lets me play it for an entire edition. I played Guard all the way through 7th edition, all the way through 8th edition. I've played Dark Angels, only played Dark Angels in 9th edition because it's an army that I'm extremely passionate about. And if without that passion, I couldn't stick on an army for more than like a couple of weeks, couple of months. So I'd love to know how we capture that in a bottle and how...
That's one thing to rank. We can rank what faction players we think are the most passionate about their army. It's definitely orcs.
It's definitely, yeah. I was about to say, does anything even come close to orcs?
Like, second is Space Wolves.
I have both of those.
that's a good call. Space Wolves players, that's a good call.
Yeah, and there's probably a lot tied for third, but...
Yeah, I think it's more branched out into super factions now, because I know people who just play Hive Mind. Like, they just play GSC and Tyranids. That's the only two things they will play. But I suppose that's one of the great things GW did with the whole. And they don't call them super factions. We, the players, call them super factions. Like, Chaos. I know so many Chaos players who used to only play Chaos Space Marines, and then 8th edition, when the game started changing, you know, sometimes month by month, they expanded to play a couple of the armies in the adjoining factions, you know. It's possibly one of the good things that came from 7th edition. When 7th edition incentivized allies, everyone got like 500 points of demons when they're a Chaos Space Marine player. They got a Magnus, you know, they got a Mortarian when it came out. And now in 8th edition and 9th edition, now they have armies of those factions. Like, they have 2,000 points of T-Suns. They have et cetera, and so on. But yeah, no, you're not wrong, mate. Like, who's at the bottom, though? If we're gonna do the top, who's the least passionate?
Least enthusiastic about their army.
Yeah.
That they own 2,000 points of at least and have painted and have spent so much time with.
I don't think that you can put anybody at the very, very bottom.
No, I'm going to do it if y'all won't do it.
Oh, spicy. Unleash.
Yeah, add mech players.
Picked it. Good. I was going to, 100%. It's got to be, right?
Why do you think that is?
Oh, because you just had to pick somebody at the bottom. There's so many cool factions. And even, there are people that, I just came from one of the conventions I went to this past weekend. There were already Tech Priest cosplayers out roaming around.
Phenomenal.
So even what we're saying is might be the least passionate players are still pretty darn passionate.
Well, they've had it removed, right?
Their passion?
Replaced
they removed it. Cleansed.
Tubes.
Been replaced with binary code, which has no place for passion.
Yeah, it's a tough metric there, but I think that there is something about that. Like, you want the lore to grab people, and that's one of the coolest things about the Warhammer stuff in general is the lore. There's people that don't know a thing about the game or the figures, but they know stuff about the lore.
Has anybody started Echoes of Eternity yet?
I downloaded it. I'm going to listen to it this week.
I'm halfway through. I think I just did Descent of Angels, and then I'm doing Angels of Caliban. And I listen to them like once every 3 to 6 months. I get my little Dark Angels refresher on, because I have no chill. And yeah, straight after that, bang, right back into Echoes of Eternity.
Yeah, it's gonna be there. Can't wait. I mean, I know how it ends.
Tanya, what book are you up to at the moment? What are you reading?
So I am still just getting started on No Fear. I had to take like a month off of reading to do late nights of painting. But now that my deadline has come and passed and I played that game, now I can actually sit down and have my reading quality time back. So, nice. Yeah, I think I'm like 4 chapters in or something now.
Love it. I just love people getting the little really insightful lore dumps. I mean, it's Ah, jeez. Please feel free to take this out if it's a spoiler. Like when everyone like found out that Armageddon was Ulanor. So, what book was that even in? Was that even in a book?
No, but anyway, campaign supplement.
Exactly, it was in a campaign supplement. It wasn't even hidden or drip fed or anything. It was just like, oh yeah, this is why. And everyone just kind of cocked their head a little bit sideways. Their eyes went wide, and they're like, oh my god, there's my next 6 months of cooler talk, like water cooler talk. And it was like, did you know? And I'm like, yeah, oh my god, it all makes sense now. And then you start going through the heresy. That happened. And then the first war of Armageddon, then the second one, and that's why they kept coming back, and they jumped in the warp, and it ended up there. And yeah, phenomenal. Those things I love so much.
Yeah, that's the trick. Is like trying to bottle that and to make sure it gets out there. And you know, with Warhammer Plus, I had to get another year of Warhammer Plus. I mean, because the figures are, of course, awesome, but then also the content is good. I don't know what I'm going to do with that Terminator, but I'm going to find something cool.
At this point, Red would say, "Oh, but what about that awesome app, Adam?" And he would say some little quippy, dry something, and I'd be like, "Red, good job. The Dark Angels of Chaos as well.
Well, you'll get that sass next week." I'm glad you filled in.
I miss it.
The more stuff, I mean, and also you got to think of the Adeptus Mechanicus. You know, I mentioned again, we're picking on them a little bit, but they're still kind of a fairly new faction as far as a playable faction.
I don't know, man. The hype for Votann is pretty real right now. Like the passion is there, and it's not even out yet.
Evoking all that nostalgia. Yeah, we'll be talking about them as soon as we can.
Does the land train or the big caravan, I don't know what you call it, the big one, the big model, the big moving fortress?
It's a fortress, yeah.
Yeah. Does that remind anyone of their like lunar buggy they got for Christmas when they were 8 years old, made of Lego?
I think I know what you're talking about. Look, we'll save the Votann discussion before we can like really look at those and break them down. I'm sure we'll get the opportunity to do so at some point.
I don't know where it comes from, but there is a deep-held reservoir of nostalgia that they stroke. And I wasn't around for second edition to play the original, so I'm trying to figure out where this feeling, you know, welling up inside me is coming from. And I swear it's some Lego.
You just feel compelled.
Yeah.
GW's sitting in their offices going, got him.
Got him. That's where got I got him. There it is.
Oh, that's funny.
That's exactly the notes we wanted to hit.
Yeah, I was like, man, you know, I said, you know, I was only going to paint Blood Angels if I was going to paint Marines, but these aren't Marines, you know?
Mm. It's not power armor.
Yeah, just some kind of armor might be cool.
Is there a red sub-faction? We'll have to wait and see.
Well, there was a figure preview that wore red armor. I don't know if that's a faction or what.
Mate, you're in.
Yeah.
It's already over.
I think that was actually my post on Twitter. It was like, well, you know, I do like red power armor. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, but I'm actually thinking about trying to go for like a yellow or something. I don't, yeah.
Use that new yellow paint. That's so amazing.
Oh, there you go.
That new contrast. It's absolutely stunning.
Okay. Well, you know, twist my arm. There we go. I guess case closed. Yeah, we'll see as we get closer to, you know, hopefully being able to talk about those if we do get any information. Speaking of yellow, though, that all the Horus Heresy stuff that's coming out has like painting instructions on it to either paint the Sons of Horus or the Imperial Fist, because that's what came in the starter box.
Oh yeah,
so it's kind of neat. And those, I mean, it's not a tutorial, but sometimes just knowing what colors to use or anybody used for a recipe is sometimes very helpful. So like my Sylvaneth.
Yeah.
This color scheme is right out of the whatever one of the tutorials in the back of the instructions on to build your models. So it's take any information you can, try to turn something good. But yellow is a challenging color.
I think that those are really good because sometimes people just really don't know where to start. Like if it's your first army and you're like, I am so overwhelmed at this paint rack. What do I even buy? And then you've got your shopping list right there. I think it's great.
Yeah. You go in there, exactly. You're looking at like, I know I need a base coat and I need a highlight color. And sometimes you can screw that up.
There's like three yellows here. Which one do I choose?
The worst I've done is blue. It's like, I don't know how to highlight blue. Like what shade is highlights blue? Who knows?
I just add white to it. Yeah. I just mix my own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
that works too. I mean, it does. I mean, it's in a pinch. I mean, there's if you are highlighting or building something, starting something new, and you don't know where to go, that is actually a really good thing to do because you probably have white.
I actually found that intimidating at first. I don't know about you guys, but I thought the idea of presuming I know about mixing colors better than G-Dub or Vallejo or P3, I actually found intimidating when I first started. I was like, shouldn't I just go with what they think and what they say highlights this color?
Why no, you definitely should because they've spent time on figuring that out. You will screw it up otherwise. I mean,
and I did. But then now I'm into the, who cares? Just shove it on. It's fine. If it, you know, because the fear is that unless you mix a whole pot of the stuff, it might look different unit to unit because you're using a different, you know, puddle of that same ratio or perceived ratio. And that was always such a huge fear of mine. But this is at the start when I was, I was fearful of a lot of things back then. Mostly because I was really, and most of those things came because I was very poor. I didn't have a lot of money. So if I ruined a model, that was it. It's not like I could replace it or anything.
Yeah, I mean, no shame in that. Yeah, and also with like a quick highlight, since we're kind of on the subject now, that might as well do a little hobby thing, is, you know, and I know we mentioned this before, but as people are going to be starting new armies and, you know, maybe getting into Heresy or any of these other games or whatever, is, you know, if you have just your base coat and a dark wash and you're one of those folks that does an all over wash, your base coat can then become the highlight.
Yes, you can re-highlight with the base coat. That's right.
That's how I do it.
There's plenty of places on the models that I do that to this day, even though I try to get a little fancy and think everything has to, you know, have a highlight color. But no, you paint a pouch or something and put Nuln oil or, you know, whatever the new color is over the top of it, Basilican Gray, you can highlight it whatever the base coat, whatever you base coated that with, and it will get you it'll get you good enough.
My tip, if people want to sort of do their first forays into mixing their own paint colors for highlights, is just to keep a journal as you go with your ratios in it, so that when you go back to do another model or another unit in the same paint scheme, you just have something to reference back to. So if your highlight is something that's other than just one-to-one, as they quite often can be, depending on if you want higher or lesser contrast in your highlights, you just keep a diary, keep a little ratio, keep notes as well about like the consistency of the paint that you're going for. So if you're doing a little trial and error and you like the highlight layer a little bit thinner, like a little waterier, maybe put your ratio of paint to water in there as well.
Did you hear that, young Adam?
I did. It's a great idea, actually.
Write it down. That is actually, I started doing that a year or so ago, and it has saved me more than once.
Yeah, I actually have a multimedia sketchbook like that I use. So if I want to, I can actually mix the paint and then paint it into the book so that I have an actual like visual reference of the color that I'm going for. That can be indispensable.
I'm still painting back in the Renaissance. Like, that's incredible tech. Wow.
Learning all kind of stuff. Well, folks, idea. I think that's our show for this week. I know we've been kind of all over the place, but, you know, we actually have been all over the place in the last weekend and trying to tell y'all a little bit about what we've been up to. And it's been a ride.
Variety is the spice.
Well, Adam and Tanya, Red will be back next week.
Can't wait, mate.
Let us know if y'all playing stuff out there. Did we see each other at Nova? Let me know. Hit me up on Twitter at warmaster_TPM or at Instagram at Fights with Dice. Maybe think about getting a shirt.
Definitely should get a shirt.
And 5-star reviews. We'll see y'all next week.
Premium body coverage product.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
'Cause they said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.